into his mother's eyes, and he wondered if she might instruct Mr. Miller to turn around and take them back to the dock. In addition to the main inn, there were a dozen or so cottages, which Mr. Miller told them were sometimes rented by artists and movie stars. The one Miles and his mother were to occupy was set slightly apart from the rest and had a rose trellis up one side. Miles liked it the best of all the cottages because it was closest to the path that led down the bluff and over the dunes to the beach. They were warned not to stray from the path because of the poison ivy. What Grace liked best about the cottage was that in the early morning when the wind shifted, they awoke to the sound of pounding surf. Miles knew how far away the water was, but the waves crashed so hard that every morning he went to the front window to make sure the whirl hadn't tilted during the night. He half expected to look out and see the waves foaming right up to the porch steps. They stayed out of the inn's dining room because Grace had gotten a quick glimpse of it when they checked in, enough to know that it would be very expensive, and to suspect she didn't have anything nice enough to wear. The cottage's galley kitchen was equipped with a small refrigerator, and Grace bought a box of cereal and a quart of milk in the village for their breakfast. By 10 o'clock each morning, someone from the inn appeared with a wicker basket full of sandwiches, fruit, and soft drinks for them to bring to the beach. Only there, among the dunes, did his mother seem truly to relax and enjoy herself. At 30, Grace was an attractive woman, and even in the company of a 9-year-old boy, she was regarded by many of the male guests with admiration open enough to be noted by their wives. One man stopped by their blanket and introduced himself, wondering why the two of them never appeared in the dining room in the evening, even offering to buy Grace a cocktail later that afternoon if she felt like it, and if her young companion could find a way to amuse himself for a while. Grace rested her chin on the knuckles of her left hand, pretending to consider this proposal, while her wedding ring reflected the sun, until the man shrugged and said, "Well, you can't blame a guy for trying." She offered no opinion as to whether you could or you couldn't. Evenings, the day's sun still glowing on their skin, they showered off the sand and salt at their cottage, dressed in shorts and tops and sandals, then strolled down the dirt road into the village for dinner at the least expensive restaurant they could find, a place called the Thirsty Whale, which specialized in takeout but also served food on a small deck under beach umbrellas. A college girl waitress took a shine to Miles and taught him how to eat steamer clams, which were served in wire baskets along with 2 cups of liquid. In the first was a hot broth containing juices of the clams themselves, but this, she explained, was really for cleansing them of sand. The second cup contained drawn butter for dipping. The clams were accompanied by a big bowl of oyster crackers. They were expensive, but Grace said it was okay, and Miles ordered them every night, working through the big wire baskets greedily. The early evening sun was usually still strong when they sat down to eat, but by the time they finished, a cool breeze would begin to ripple the umbrella above them, and Miles, full of buttery clams, would become deliciously drowsy, so the walk back to Summer House seemed impossibly long. The few stores in the village stayed open late, and one evening, Grace stopped in one to look at a summer dress in the window. By the time she'd tried on one in her size and decided to buy it, Miles had fallen asleep in a chair by the door. On the way back to the cottage in the pitch-dark night, Miles asked a question that, perhaps during his nap, had arisen in him from somewhere. "Mom," he said, "are we waiting for somebody?" He felt his mother stop walking and regard him in the darkness. "What gave you that idea?" Perhaps because there was no one else, the person Miles thought they must be waiting for was his father, even though his mother and Max had had a huge fight earlier in the week before her surprise announcement that she was going to Martha's Vineyard. In fact, after the argument, Miles hadn't even seen his father before they left Empire Falls, though this was not terribly unusual. Max often disappeared without notice after such disputes, possibly imagining that his absence would teach Grace a lesson. Sometimes, though, more often in winter than in summer, he'd disappear for months, heading down to the Keys, where the weather was warmer, and he could pick up work painting houses or crewing on the schooners that took tourists on sunset sails. He didn't send money home when he was gone, nor did he consider this an abandonment of his wife and child. To Max's way of thinking, his being gone meant Grace had one less mouth to feed, and, more significant, no bar bill to pay out of her salary at the Empire Shirt Factory. This, far from abandonment, was something of a financial windfall, and he was not shy about reminding her of that whenever she might be tempted to feel herself ill-used. Of course, Max would disappear in the summertime, too. The best prospects for house painters were on the coast in places like Camden and Blue Hill and Castine, where rich people from Massachusetts had summer homes and the money to repaint them at the first sign of flaking. Even better, these people, not being local, wouldn't necessarily know of Max's aversion to scraping, indeed, to all the more time-intensive aspects of any task. Nor were they likely to discover he'd painted their windows shut until after he was long gone. By the time they'd discovered his shoddy work in Booth Bay, he'd be painting someone else's window shut in Bar Harbor. To fire an unreliable painter in season on the coast of Maine was hard, because chances were good he'd have to be replaced by an even shoddier one. During July and August, poor Mainers held a distinct advantage over the rich, which was why these 2 months were particularly satisfying to Max Roby. So when Max disappeared the day after the most recent blow-up, Miles assumed he'd simply hitched a ride to the coast. He'd earn some money, get himself fired when the time was right, then join them here on the island for the last few days of their vacation. They had never gone on a vacation without Max before, which was why Miles expected his father to turn up eventually. His mother twice went up to the main house to make phone calls, and she had to be calling somebody. When she returned, she seemed downcast, which Miles took to mean that his father was either tied up with work or still miffed. Miles himself was relieved. His mother had instinctively understood that they didn't belong at Summer House, but his father felt welcomed everywhere, even when he clearly was not. If Max were to join them, he'd set up shop at the end of the bar and make fun of the gold-buttoned, blue-blazered men and their hefty, lilac-scented wives until he got 86th. On his way out, he'd likely drop his pants and moon the lot of them. Late one afternoon, just 2 days before Miles and his mother were to leave, Miles was showing off in the surf and ignoring his mother's pleas to come in and dry off for dinner when he noticed that she wasn't really paying attention, even when he called to her. These last few days, he'd learned to enjoy her alarm when a particularly demonstrative wave would crash over him and wash him up on the beach. In fact, since arriving on the island, she'd been a ready audience for all his foolishness. But at the moment, she had her back to him, shading her eyes against the sun, and when he followed her gaze, he saw a solitary figure up on the bluff, backlit by the late afternoon sun, staring down at the beach. Almost everyone else had already packed up their things and headed up the twisting, sandy footpath, and when the man on the bluff appeared to wave, Miles looked around and found no one else he might be waving to. He looked back at his mother just as she dropped the hand that had been shading her eyes. Had she waved back at the man? Probably not, he decided, when she turned away from the bluff and called again for Miles to come in. "Who was that?" he asked when his mother began toweling him off. "Who was who?" Back at the cottage, she insisted that he shower before they went out to dinner, and when he emerged, dressed in shorts and a T-shirt, Grace told him to go back and put on a nicer shirt and a pair of long pants and real shoes, not sneakers. Tonight, they were going to eat in Summer House's main dining room. She herself was going to wear the new white dress she'd bought in the village. Miles looked in vain for steamer clams on the menu at the surf club. In fact, there was nothing he recognized, including the language many selections were written in, which his mother informed him was French. To Miles, none of this boded well. There was no advantage that he could see to dressing up in long pants and a stiff shirt and shoes to eat indoors on a white tablecloth when they might have been dressed comfortably and seated under one of the colorful umbrellas outside the Thirsty Whale and eating steamer clams in English. He especially resented the long pants because he was itchy on his calves and thighs. The day before, on the way up the footpath from the beach, he'd tossed himself a pop fly and had to chase it into the thicket. And this afternoon in the shower, he'd noticed patches of rough red skin. When he got out, he rubbed them with one of the rough white towels that were delivered to the cottage each day, rubbed the dry skin past the point of ecstasy to where it began to glow and hurt. Now these same patches were itching again, and he couldn't get at them. Even worse, his mother had given him a long list of do's and don'ts, saying this was an adult dinner. It was going to last a long time, which was a good thing. He wasn't to fidget or scratch. He hadn't even been allowed to bring his mitt along. Miles had to admit that he'd never seen his mother look more beautiful than she did tonight. Her skin had darkened during their week on the beach, but she'd been careful not to burn, and her new white dress made a fine contrast of fabric and skin. And the fact that she was wearing perfume made him wonder if maybe his father would be joining them after all, though that didn't make sense, not with only one more day on the island. The dining room was nearly full, yet strangely quiet. Miles couldn't remember ever seeing so many people in one room making so little noise. Piano music was coming from somewhere, barely audible, and over it you could hear the noise of cutlery. When Miles examined the menu and observed that there were no steamer clams, Grace leaned forward and whispered that he would have to keep his voice down. At the next table was seated a man with white hair and sad eyes, sipping a cocktail and looking at his own menu. Like half the men in the dining room, he wore a navy blue blazer with gold buttons, and he had smiled at Miles and his mother when they sat down. In fact, every man in the room had managed to turn and look at Grace, though most immediately pretended it was something else that had caught their attention. When the white-haired man heard Miles' remark on the absence of steamer clams, he lowered his menu and leaned toward them.
"I hope you'll forgive the intrusion," he said, "but I suspect your charming companion might like the Clams Casino. They're excellent here."
Miles studied the man as he spoke, trying to judge his age. Because of his fine white hair, Miles at first thought he must be old, but his face was smooth, and the longer Miles looked at him, the younger he seemed. He was older than Grace, of course, though Miles couldn't tell how much older. The way his mother returned his smile also suggested that he wasn't just some old man. "What do you think, Miles?" she said. "Do you trust this gentleman?" Miles weighed this question carefully. It should have been an easy one, but somehow wasn't. And before he could decide, the man got the attention of a passing waiter and ordered half a dozen of the Clams Casino, telling Grace, "Don't worry, if he doesn't like them, I do." To Miles' surprise, his mother entered into a conversation with the man, explaining that clams of any sort were a new experience for her son, and that since discovering them, he didn't want to eat anything else. The man smiled.
"Sounds like he's going to have a taste for the good things in life."
"Well, we're on vacation," Grace said, introducing herself and Miles, then hesitating. "Do you mind my asking if you're eating alone?"
"Alas."
"Maybe you'd like to join us."
"I'd be delighted," the man said. "Though I seem to have the larger table, why don't you and Mr. Miles join me at mine?"
This suggestion was no sooner made than two waiters appeared to put the plan into effect. Miles at first was not thrilled with the idea, until the man asked what his favorite sport was. Since arriving, Miles had been acutely aware of how many men would have introduced themselves to his mother if Miles himself had not been there to dissuade them. But this appeared to be a different sort of fellow altogether, and so when asked about his favorite sport, Miles said baseball,
and then, without further encouragement, launched into the story of his amazing catch the week before. When he finished, he told the story all over again, in case the man had missed any of its nuances. The tale carried them through their appetizers quite nicely, he thought. As predicted, Miles liked these new clams a lot, though he was disappointed not to get a whole bucket of them like at the Thirsty Whale. The man's name was Charlie Maine, and he spelled it out loud so as to differentiate it from the state where Miles and his mother resided. For some reason, Miles's mother seemed surprised by the name, though Miles thought it suited him well enough. While Miles had been devouring his clams, Charlie Maine busied himself with expertly extracting what looked like large pencil erasers from inside curved shells that reminded Miles of something, though he couldn't think what. During the week he'd spent hours combing the beach for shells, but he hadn't found any that looked like these.
"Like to try one?" the man said when he saw Miles studying them.
The pencil erasers didn't look all that appetizing, but then again, they didn't look any worse than steamer clams with their little sheathed black penises, so Miles tried one. The thing turned out to taste pretty much as he would have predicted, a chewy little devil, but tasty too. And when he was offered another, he promptly accepted, though Grace protested that the first gift was more than sufficient.
"Not at all," Charlie Maine insisted. "I'm enjoying this as much as he is. Should we tell him what he's eating?"
He was grinning at Miles's mother now, and Miles noted that his eyes remained sad even when he smiled. And when his mother returned his sad smile with one of her own, it occurred to Miles that they made a couple in some strange way that Grace and his father did not.
"Some secrets are best kept, Mr. Maine," his mother said, "at least for a while."
But Miles, who sensed that Charlie Maine was a man who'd cave under tough cross-examination, kept after him to say what the pencil erasers were until Charlie gave in and told him he'd eaten an escargot. This was such a disappointing revelation that Miles suspected he was being lied to, and moreover, that his mother was in on it. If that was true, it was all in good fun, of course, but to think that his mother might take Charlie Maine's part against him was still disquieting. But it turned out not to be a lie after all. When their menus were returned so they could order a main course, Miles saw the item in question listed under appetizers, escargot du maison, served in their shells with garlic butter. And it occurred to him that Charlie Maine had been right, having taken one look at Miles before and concluding that here was a boy who'd grow fond of the finer things in life. After they finished their dinner and Charlie Maine made the bill simply disappear, with no money changing hands, he asked if they'd seen the rest of the island. Grace explained they hadn't left the grounds of Summerhouse except to walk to the village, and Charlie, as Miles now thought of him, consulted his watch and then proclaimed there might still be time if they hurried. When they asked what he was referring to, he just smiled and said they'd see. They hurried, or rather Charlie hurried. He drove a little bright yellow sports car with just enough room for himself and Miles' mother in the two front seats, a stick shift between them, and Miles squeezed into a narrow space behind them. They flew across the island, Charlie taking the curves at thrilling speed. With the top down, his longish hair flowed out straight behind him like a wild white mane. He offered Grace a canvas sailor hat, which she managed to keep on only by clamping it down with one hand. Miles kept expecting her to ask Charlie to slow down. She had a fit whenever Max sped, but for some reason she didn't object now. At least Miles didn't think she did. With the top down, the wind was roaring so loudly that he couldn't hear anything being said in the front seat. It felt like the corners of his eyes were actually being drawn back along his cheeks by the speed, and he wondered if he'd looked Chinese by the time they arrived at wherever they were going. Eventually, the pavement came to an end, and Charlie Maine pulled the little car onto a dirt road that ended 100 yards farther on in a sandy lot, where he parked by a log fence at the very edge of a sloping beach. The sun, incredibly large and orange, sat inches above the calm waters of Vineyard Sound,
And when the engine died, Miles heard his mother say, "Oh, Charlie, look." And when Miles asked what it was that they'd hurried to see, both she and Charlie laughed, making him feel foolish, though he noted that he wasn't the only one not paying strict attention to the sunset. Half a dozen other cars were in the lot, and Miles could see a couple kissing in the nearest one. To his surprise, when he asked his mother if he could go down to the beach, she said sure, so long as he took his shoes and socks off and rolled up the cuffs of his pants and promised not to wade in the surf. "And no more than 10 minutes," she warned him. "It's going to get dark fast." It did, for which Miles was grateful. The patches of rough skin he'd scratched raw in the shower were now pulsing, and he'd been too cramped in the back seat to really get at them. Once he got out of sight, he intended to scratch himself into ecstasy. So when he scrambled over the dunes, he was both surprised and discouraged to discover that the beach wasn't deserted as he'd expected. Spaced evenly, as far into the distance as he could make out, were fishermen casting way out into the gentle waves, then furiously reeling in, then casting again. Miles watched them for a few minutes, trying to make sense of it. Max had taken him fishing on the lake once, but there you just dropped a line over the side of the boat and waited for something to pull on it. These men seemed almost to be in a competition to see who could cast the farthest into the waves, and since every cast was a disappointment, they reeled in and tried again. The closest one called out a warning, and Miles saw why a second later when the man drew back his long rod and something silver flashed and whistled through the air behind him and then shot far out into the waves. Keeping what he hoped was a safe distance behind the casters, Miles trudged up the beach until he came to a secluded spot among the dunes and the tall seagrass. There he lowered his pants down around his ankles and began scratching. It was too dark to tell for sure, but the splotches of rough red skin seemed to have doubled in size since his shower. Digging at them with his fingernails was midway between intense pleasure and pain, and he would have kept at it until he bled had he not heard a sound nearby, and then low voices. He quickly pulled up his trousers and hurried away. Back up the beach, he heard another sound, more like flapping this time. And when he looked down, he was surprised to see a large silver fish, bloody at the gills, flopping in the sand at his feet. "Careful," said a voice a few feet away, where a man crouched, tying a silver lure onto his line. "They got teeth." It was almost completely dark by the time he arrived back at the parking lot, where he found Charlie Maine's little car more by the size and shape of its silhouette than anything else. He fully expected his mother to scold him for staying too long on the beach, but he was wrong. There'd been just enough light to see his mother's head resting on Charlie Maine's shoulder before they heard him coming. The next morning, aware that he'd been dreaming vividly all night long, Miles awakened to the sound of his mother retching into the toilet of the cottage's tiny bathroom. This was actually the second or third morning he'd heard this, and today he was angry with her, though he hadn't been when he went to sleep. It seemed to have something to do with catching that glimpse of the two of them in the car, but even more, he sensed that during the night things had somehow realigned themselves. His mother's asking a stranger to join them at dinner did suggest that his own company left something to be desired. Not that he didn't like Charlie, he did. But Miles found himself angry with the man, too. Charlie, who'd been so attentive during dinner, hadn't seemed particularly interested in hearing about the gasping silver fish Miles had seen on the beach. And when he exaggerated his peril by telling them he'd nearly been snagged by the lure of one of the surf casters, neither his mother nor Charlie seemed as frightened as he might have wished. Worse, he woke that morning almost nauseous with the understanding that the night before he'd actually eaten a snail. He discovered, however, that it was hard to stay mad at someone you love when she's throwing up in the next room. And so, to preserve the satisfaction of his righteous anger, he went outside with his glove and ball to throw himself pop flies and await the picnic basket from the main house. When it arrived, it was heavier than usual, and he lugged it inside and set it on the breakfast table, where his mother, still in her nightgown, sat with her head in her hands. When she looked up at him, pale and discouraged and clearly exhausted, the anger he'd been trying to protect drained out of him completely. "Are you sick?" he asked, suddenly afraid. "I wish I were," she said with a rueful smile. "Then I could look forward to getting well." He noticed that as she spoke, she was idly scratching a patch of red skin on her forearm. "Don't worry," she added. "I'm not dying or anything." Miles was going through the picnic basket. The instant she told him not to worry, he'd taken her advice and quit. "There's a lot more stuff today," he informed her, holding up a small jar of what appeared to be inky little ball bearings. This news seemed to cheer her, and Grace rose from the table and threw open the curtains over the kitchen window and stood in the bright sunlight that flooded the room. She stood there for a long moment, her eyes closed, seeming to soak in the sun's rays with something like a smile forming on her lips. For a woman who'd spent the last hour on her hands and knees in front of the commode, Miles thought she looked very beautiful, and he decided to forgive her for last night. After all, it was their last day on the island. They'd not been on the beach for more than a half an hour, though, when Charlie Maine showed up. Miles was pleased to note that he had scrawny, white, almost hairless legs, and when he pulled his sweatshirt over his head, Miles saw a pale, concave chest with a few strands of coarse black hair encircling his nipples. Though his mother was not a large woman, Miles now realized, seeing them side by side, that she was a full size larger than Charlie. Last night, especially in the sports car, he'd seemed average-sized. But today, as he settled onto a corner of their blanket, he looked downright puny. Surely, Miles thought, his mother would notice this and send him packing. "Didn't they make you a lunch basket?" she inquired.
"Alas, they did not," said Charlie, who didn't look concerned.
"Then you'll share ours," Grace told him. To look at her now, you'd never guess how sick she'd been an hour earlier, nor did she display any inclination towards sending Charlie Maine away. "You'll be pleased to learn, however, that I have not come completely empty-handed." And from the pocket of his swimming trunks, he took out a long white tube, showed it to Grace, and then tossed it to Miles, who fielded it with his mitt. Grace clapped her hands in delight. "Oh, Charlie, you're a lifesaver."
"That's me," he agreed.
"They told me up at the main house that they were all out," she said, motioning for Miles to bring her the tube of ointment.
"I drove into Edgartown this morning," Charlie explained, while Grace applied the poison ivy cream to Miles' legs and stomach, then to her own forearms and a patch Miles hadn't noticed before on her upper thigh. "In fact, I got the last tube at the drugstore. Apparently this is a banner year for poison ivy all over the island."
Charlie Maine watched her massage the cream into her thigh until he noticed Miles, who had yet to say hello, staring intently at him, and then turned his attention to the picnic basket. When he found the inky-looking jar, he held it up for Miles' inspection.
"Ever tasted caviar, big guy?"
Miles shook his head, still feeling tricked on the subject of specialty foods by last night's snail. He made a mental note to refuse the caviar when it was offered, not because it wouldn't be good, probably, but because Charlie Maine would be doing the offering. Last night he'd been pleased to be recognized as a person who appreciated the finer things. This morning, everything had changed. In fact, he now wished he'd refused the ointment, because he could already feel it cooling the patches of infected skin, and stubbornly pretended that he preferred the itching. "I also found us a great place for dinner," Charlie was saying to his mother, "but you have to promise to wear that white dress again." His mother had put on sunglasses and rolled onto her back. "It's the only one I have." She laughed, and Miles could feel his anger returning. Without even discussing it with him, she was letting Charlie Maine come to dinner with them. "I want to eat at the Thirsty Whale tonight," Miles said, nudging her foot with his. I want steamer clams.
His mother sighed contentedly. Just feel that, son, she purred.
Miles nudged her foot again. Did you hear me?
He could tell, even through the sunglasses, that her eyes were closed. She didn't open them when she spoke.
No, I didn't hear you, she said. And if you continue to be rude, I won't hear you then, either.
Charlie Mayne didn't seem to understand they were having an argument.
So it's steamer clams you want, he said cheerfully, stretching out on his stomach.
His back also sported random curly black hairs, about a dozen of them. Ridiculous.
Look at his back, Miles would have liked to tell his mother. Her problem, he was certain, was that she wasn't paying attention.
Then it's steamer clams you'll get, Charlie finished.
Late that afternoon, when Grace came out of the bathroom, freshly showered and dressed in her robe, Miles told her he didn't want to go out to dinner with Charlie. He wanted for it to be just the two of them. They'd been having fun, he told her, before Charlie Mayne showed up.
Yeah? Grace said, angry so instantly that it scared Miles, as if she'd just been waiting for him to say something like this.
Well, I've been having fun since he showed up. What do you think about that?
Miles didn't answer immediately.
Dad wouldn't like it, he said, looking right at her.
Tough. I'll tell.
Fine, she said, surprising him again, increasing the sensation he'd been feeling all day that everything was adrift. She'd taken out the ointment and was applying cream to her skin.
Then tell.
I will, he said, knowing it was the wrong thing, but saying it anyway.
You'll have to wait till he gets out of jail, though, she said, her eyes suddenly harder than he'd ever seen them.
She hadn't so much spoken the words as let them out of their cages, and she watched him now as if purely curious as to the effect they'd have. If necessary, she had more of them to turn loose.
You didn't know that, did you? That your father was in jail.
She'd propped one foot up on the kitchen chair to apply the ointment, and when she put that one down and the other one up, her robe gaped, and Miles caught a dark glimpse of what he knew he was not supposed to see, what he didn't see, not really, because his eyes were already filling with tears.
You want to know why, Miles? Because last week he was arrested as a public nuisance. That's why. Not for the first time, either. He becomes a public nuisance every now and then when he tires of being a private one. And I'll tell you something else, too. You think Max Roby would care if you told him about Charlie Mayne? Think again. Your father cares only about your father. I wish that weren't so, but it is, and you're old enough to know it. The sooner you understand it, the better off you'll be.
Finished with applying the ointment, she stood facing him. And I'll tell you one more thing while I'm at it. When we get back home, things are going to be very different, so you can prepare yourself for that, too.
To punish her, when Grace went to change into the white dress, Miles, instead of getting into the shower as instructed, slipped out the back and returned to the now deserted beach beneath the bluff, where he threw towering pop flies as high as he could until an errant, angry throw sent the ball into the waves. Then he just sat down in the sand, pounding the palm of his glove and wishing they'd never come to Martha's Vineyard. Suddenly he was no longer afraid of ground balls, no matter how sharply struck. If he got hit by one, so what? He understood now what Mr. LaSalle had been trying to teach him all summer. It didn't matter if you got hit. It didn't matter if it hurt. After a while, he heard someone coming down the footpath behind him. When he turned around, he thought it would be his mother, furious, coming to fetch him. But it was Charlie Mayne, walking across the sand in a pair of shiny black shoes. He had on a pair of nice pants, and Miles didn't expect him to sit down. But he did.
What happened to the ball?
Miles pointed at the waves.
Charlie Mayne nodded.
You and your mother had an argument?
Miles didn't say anything.
Your mother's an awfully nice person, you know, Charlie finally said.
I know she's nice, Miles said angrily, not wanting to be told something he already knew, not by somebody who'd only known his mother for 2 days.
She loves you.
I know, Miles said.
She said for me to tell you she's sorry about the things she said about your dad. That wasn't such a good thing to do.
Miles shrugged. The thing is, the man went on, everyone deserves a chance to be happy, you know. She is happy. And there comes a time in your life when you realize that if you don't take the opportunity to be happy, you may never get another chance again. She is happy, Miles insisted. Actually, he said, I was talking about me. Your mother is the kind of woman who, well, she's like the sun suddenly coming out from behind a cloud. Miles didn't say anything to this, but it did remind him of how she'd looked that morning when she'd thrown open the kitchen curtains. She makes everything look new, sort of. When Miles didn't say anything to this either, Charlie added, Anyway, to make me happy if I might join the two of you for dinner this evening, but it's up to you. Miles shrugged. Charlie Mayne nodded and waited. Finally, he said, What's that mean, that shrug? Another shrug. Well, he said, I guess it could mean that it's okay for me to come to dinner, or it could mean you'd prefer I didn't, or it could mean you wish the whole world were different from the way it is, right? Shrug. Charlie Mayne nodded again. Right, he said. Gotcha. They ate in a restaurant called Cock of the Walk, and like the evening before, the man paid more attention to Miles than to his mother. Though steamer clams were not on the menu, Charlie suggested Miles order them anyway, and then winked at the waiter. When they came, it was a mound of clams that no three grown people could have eaten, though Charlie seemed to enjoy watching Miles try. Look at him go, he said to Grace, who was trying not to be mad at Miles anymore. When she smiled and told him not to eat himself sick, he said not to worry, and besides, he wasn't the one getting sick every morning. Charlie blanched when he said this, and for a few minutes there was only the sound of empty clamshells rattling into the bowl the restaurant had provided for this purpose. A couple of times, Miles considered that they were enjoying themselves in an expensive restaurant with a man who drove a fancy sports car while his father was sitting in an Empire Falls jail cell. But this thought was only momentarily disconcerting. Whenever he decided he should take his father's side, he remembered what Charlie Mayne had said about everybody deserving the opportunity to be happy, and concluded this was probably true. He understood, too, why his mother might prefer, at least for a day or two, the company of a man who made nice things happen, as Charlie Mayne seemed able to do by mere whim, to that of a convicted public nuisance. At first, the news of his father's being arrested had mortified and humiliated him. But the more he thought about it, the more comforted he felt. Until this afternoon, he'd always known that his father was a different sort of man from other boys' fathers, but he'd had no way of summing him up. Now he did. Max Roby was a public nuisance. Having this short phrase to describe him was better than suspecting that his father was so different and unnatural that nobody had yet invented a way to describe him. Only later that night, just before dawn, in fact, did the sadness of all this hit him, and he woke up frightened for reasons he couldn't name. He seemed to have been dreaming about his father, though he couldn't remember any details, and now, lying alone in bed, he felt guilty. Surely his father deserved a better summation than public nuisance. He wondered if Max would be mad when he got out of jail and found them gone, which got him thinking that maybe he'd already been released and found out somehow where they'd gone. Maybe he was on his way right now to gather up his family, to seize them by the wrists and yank them back to Empire Falls where they belonged, with orders to behave themselves and quit eating snails. Miles had just about convinced himself that all of this was possible when in the perfect stillness outside the bedroom window, he heard a noise. A milky mist had rolled in off the ocean, amplifying sounds, including the far-off ringing of a boy. Through the parted curtains next to his bed, Miles squinted into the mist until he was certain that he'd imagined the sound. But then there came another, a footfall on the gravel path, and then the mist gathered itself around a dark shape coming toward him, and finally the mist became his mother, making her way along the grassy edge of the dirt path, carrying her shoes in one hand and concentrating on her footing. The sight so startled Miles that before he could reconcile seeing his mother outside with his belief that she was asleep in the next bedroom, she looked up and stared right at him before he could let the curtains fall back into place. Charlie Mayne drove them to the ferry in silence and helped them load their bags onto the luggage trolley. Then he got the man at the ramp to let him come aboard without a ticket so he could see Miles and his mother off. It was the thing about him that amazed Miles most, that he would remember longest, the way he could make things happen and get people to do things for him that they never would have dreamed of doing for anyone else. If you happened to be with Charlie Mayne, you could eat steamer clams in a restaurant that didn't even serve them. Yet despite his amazing talent, there were clearly limits to his powers. And as Charlie stood there on the upper deck of the Vineyard Ferry, one of the things he couldn't seem to do was find the words to say whatever it was he wanted to say to Grace. Miles watched him struggle, unaware at the time that his own presence stole half the words away, and that the other half were inadequate to the message. His mother, so radiant by candlelight in her white dress the night before, looked pale and fragile in the harsh morning light, and Charlie himself looked haggard and unsure. And for the first time, his clothes seemed to hint at the awkward, concave-chested body they contained. He looked, Miles thought, plain old, which was strange because that had been his first impression 2 nights ago, before he looked more closely. Below them, the final passengers were moving in line up the plank, the last of the automobiles being loaded into the belly of the ship. In a moment, Miles could tell, the ramp would be detached and the ferry would pull away from the slip. Finally, Charlie Mayne took Grace by the hand and said, "Look, the thing is, it's going to take a while." "I know," she said, looking away from him, off toward Vineyard Haven.
"Think of Puerto Vallarta."
"I will."
"Promise me you won't lose heart."
"You need to go," she said, pointing to the dock workers below, who had begun to detach the foot ramp. He saw that this was true, but took a moment to address Miles.
"Maybe we'll meet again," he said, offering the boy his hand to shake. And when Miles did, he noticed a big blotch of poison ivy on Charlie's forearm.
"Charlie," Grace said. The ramp was being pulled away now. They faced each other.
"Grace." "I know," Grace said. "I know. Go."
And then he was off, waving and hollering to the workmen below as he hurried down to the lower deck. Without protest, they wheeled the ramp back into place, and when he'd safely descended, Charlie shook hands with each man, as if, collectively, they'd managed to pull off some complex and wonderful feat. Then, as the whistle blew and the ferry began to push back from the slip, Charlie Mayne continued to stand there at the very edge of the dock, waving to them. He continued to wave until he was small, pausing only, Miles could tell, to scratch his forearm. Miles couldn't help feeling sorry for him, left behind on the island without any ointment, with nothing to relieve his suffering. Eventually, then, he realized his mother was no longer at his side. The island had disappeared entirely, and the thin line of the Cape Cod coast was becoming visible on the horizon when Grace returned to the deck. Miles could tell she'd been sick again, and as she came toward him, wobbly and weak, she looked so little like the figure who had materialized out of the morning mist that he wondered if maybe he'd dreamed it. In case he hadn't, when she sat down next to him, he said, "I won't tell Dad, I promise." He knew she'd heard him, but it was as if she hadn't. She took his hand, and neither of them spoke until the ferry pulled into the harbor at Woods Hole, and the ferry bumped roughly against the sides of the slip before coming to rest. They were standing at the rail, Grace gripping it with white fingers, until she took a deep breath and said, "I was wrong." He started to say something, but she shook her head, stopping him. "I was wrong when I said things were going to be different when we got back home," she said. "Nothing's going to change. Not one thing."
He hoped she was right, but feared she wasn't. On the dock below, there was a man wearing a Red Sox cap, and seeing this caused Miles to remember that he'd forgotten his mitt. He could see it on the nightstand next to his bed, back at the cottage, right where he'd left it. Part 2. Chapter 9. Even before Miles crossed the iron bridge on his way to Mrs. Whiting's, he was not in the best of moods. The last several days had been gray and drizzly, too wet to get any painting done at St. Cat's. This morning the skies had finally cleared, offering the prospect of a long, brilliant afternoon under a high sky the color of a robin's egg. On a day such as this, Miles thought, a man frightened of heights might just surprise himself and find the courage to paint a church steeple. Or might have, if he hadn't gotten a call from his employer saying she had a surprise for him if he cared to drop by that afternoon. Though he knew better than to get his hopes up, Miles briefly considered the possibility, as he turned between the two stone pillars and into the circular drive, that the old woman had changed her mind about the liquor license. Or maybe she was still thinking he should be mayor and wanted to inform him that she was funding his campaign. But no sooner had he parked in front of the main house, climbed out of the Jetta, and started toward the front door than the precise nature of Mrs. Whiting's surprise became clear, and it stopped Miles dead in his tracks. The far door of the two-car garage, the one that usually remained shut, now stood wide open, revealing in its bay the old beige Lincoln with its wheelchair license plate. At this sight, Miles Roby, a grown man, had to summon every ounce of intestinal fortitude he possessed to mount the steps and ring the bell, instead of getting back in his car and leaving a thick patch of burning rubber on the asphalt. Which was precisely how Max would have handled the situation, Miles knew, and standing dutifully at the front door, he wondered, as he often had throughout his adult life, what it was in his character that prevented him from embracing his father's cheerful, sensible cowardice in the face of unpleasantness. Max had exactly zero desire to suffer himself, and even less to share the suffering of others. To his way of thinking, this reluctance required neither excuse nor explanation. It was the people who enjoyed suffering who had some explaining to do. Before Miles could come to any conclusion as to why his father's excellent instinct for self-preservation had been left out of him, the door grunted open, and there was Cindy Whiting, struggling as she always had struggled from the time she was a child, to get out of her own way, to wrestle into compliance the mangled body that had thwarted her so relentlessly. She'd graduated, Miles noted at once, from the cane she'd been using the last time he saw her, maybe 5 years ago, to a sturdy four-legged aluminum walker. She must have made the transition fairly recently, because she didn't seem to have mastered the contraption yet. Either that, or opening a door from behind such a device was sufficiently difficult that you could spend a lifetime getting the hang of it. In order to reach the doorknob, you probably had to place the walker right up against the frame, but then the walker itself would prevent the door from opening, except in short, clumsy, humiliating stages, one thump at a time. "Cindy," Miles said through the half-open doorway, feigning surprise and delight, "I had no idea you were home." Her eyes were already full of tears.
"Oh, Miles,"
she exclaimed, covering her mouth with her free hand, overcome with emotion.
"I so wanted to surprise you, and I have, haven't I?"
"You look wonderful," Miles said, an exaggeration perhaps, though she did look surprisingly healthy. She put on about 10 pounds, and the weight had heightened her color. Cindy Whiting would never be beautiful, but she could have been attractive if she'd had good advice and not been drawn to dowdy clothes and hairstyles at least a decade too old for her. At 20, she'd already begun to resemble the spinster. At 30, she'd settled into the role. Now at 42, Miles knew because they were born on the same day in the Empire Falls Hospital,
She seemed to have discovered some hint of womanliness, or even forgotten girlishness.
"Come in," she said, "and let me get a look at you."
But when he stepped forward, he stubbed his toe against the walker, causing Cindy once again to grab hold with both hands.
"I'm still the picture of Grace, as you can see," she said,
illustrating her point by pretending to lose her balance. And Miles, who throughout his life had practiced a necessary hard-heartedness toward her, felt something in him soften. Since she was a teenager, she tried to deflect her tragic awkwardness with self-mockery, chiefly pratfalls, which she never seemed to realize didn't make a very good joke. For one thing, these make-believe spasms were indistinguishable from her real ones, and they invariably sent people lunging to catch her. Worse, her feigned stumbles sometimes resulted in actual ones, and then she often fell even more violently than she would have had it occurred naturally. Her wrists, Miles knew, were full of surgical pins, but apparently her need to mock herself was greater than her fear of broken bones. In a similar circumstance, Miles would have given another woman a hug, but then another woman would have understood that she was supposed to let go, that the hug meant nothing more than, "Hello, it's been a long time." This woman would have used the opportunity to clutch him like grim death, sobbing moistly, her makeup dissolving into his shirt front.
"Oh, Miles! Oh, dear, dear Miles!"
The last time he'd seen her, she'd raised her two canes into the air like a TV cripple at an evangelical revival and pitched forward into his terrified embrace, forcing him to hug her almost as tightly as she was hugging him, to keep her from slithering down his trunk to the ground, which was why he was grateful, God forgive him, he was, for this new aluminum contraption that allowed him to lean forward and give her a chaste peck on the cheek, to him a more successful greeting than he might have expected from someone who'd been in love with him since grade school, and as proof, had attempted suicide twice on his behalf, once on the night of the senior prom, and then again on the day he married Janine. Actually, she'd attempted suicide on other occasions as well, though Miles hadn't been cited as the reason. "So," he said clumsily, in the throes of a rhetorical dilemma that not many people he suspected had ever faced, "what precisely to say to a woman who has attempted to end her life on your behalf?"
"How are you, Cindy?"
"Well, Miles," she replied, "I'm so, so well. The doctors are amazed." Then adding, as if aware of the implausibility of this, "they say it's a miracle. It's as if my psyche just suddenly decided to heal. I haven't had any setbacks in..."
Here she stopped to think, apparently doing the math in her head, though Miles had no idea what numbers she might be adding or subtracting, whether they were large or small, representing days, weeks, months, or years. While she calculated, Miles took in the entry hall and living room of the Whiting home, and felt, as always, vaguely uncomfortable. While the rooms were spacious, the ceilings were low, creating in Miles, a large man, not so much a sense of claustrophobia as of a great weight bearing down. Mrs. Whiting was a collector, and the walls were covered with original art, but most of the paintings, he thought, were not well displayed. The larger pieces overpowered the walls on which they hung. Even his own favorites, some smaller John Marrons, looked out of place. Outdoor main scenes held captive indoors against their will. Conspicuously missing were family photos, all of which Mrs. Whiting had donated to the old Whiting mansion downtown. Neither Whitings nor Robideaus were anywhere in evidence.
"Anyway," Cindy Whiting said, apparently having given up, "it seems I'm to begin life again like a normal person at age 39. You may congratulate me."
"That's wonderful news, Cindy," Miles said, swallowing this outrageous lie whole. Miles, having been born on the same day, was the one person in the world not likely to forget how old she really was. On the other hand, her desire to be 39 instead of 42 might, he supposed, be evidence that what she told him was true, that something in her psyche had healed. After all, shaving off a few years was something normal women were known to do. Maybe Cindy had learned to replace big lies, for instance, that Miles Roby was in love with her, or one day would be, that had compromised her sanity, with smaller, more harmless and optimistic ones, like imagining that one sunny day you'll wake up able to climb a ladder and paint a church steeple, right up there in the middle of the blue sky. It could happen. Where would you live? These words were no sooner out than Miles realized they formed a hurtful question, which he hadn't intended. Why, right here, of course. Where else? Of course, that's not what I meant, he quickly lied. I guess I was wondering if you'd live with your mother, or only until I can find a place of my own, she said, smiling at the thought. A grown woman should be able to come and go as she pleases, don't you think? Entertain who she pleases? Before Miles could offer an opinion on the conduct of grown women, there was a loud hissing sound behind him, and he didn't need to turn around to know that his nemesis had joined them. The cat had been called Timmy from kittenhood, when, despite her actual gender, she was still thought to be male because of her aggressive viciousness. The tiny animal, soaking wet, its fur matted, its yellow eyes wild with fright and rage, had appeared one morning on the Whiting patio, where it howled so balefully that Cindy Whiting, home on a furlough from the state facility in Augusta, had taken it in and nursed it to health. Someone, presumably, had tossed the kitten into the river somewhere upstream, expecting it either to drown or be dashed on the rocks at the falls. A scrap of burlap had been attached to one of its talons, suggesting that Timmy had started her river journey in a sack, perhaps to judge from the depth of her psychosis in the company of her siblings. At any rate, once she got her strength back, Timmy was one pissed-off little critter whose single ambition in life seemed to be to shred the world around her. Neutering seemed a good idea, though the vet she was taken to for castration had quickly pointed out an impractical one, given her gender. To Miles, Timmy's gender seemed less the issue than her metaphysical nature, which appeared to be less feline than demonic. Horace Weymouth, who in his capacity as an Empire Gazette reporter had interviewed Mrs. Whiting at her residence more than once, swore that Timmy was the old woman's familiar, and Miles, who noted that the cat's sudden appearance often coincided with the mention or advent of Mrs. Whiting, was inclined to agree. Since Timmy had no testicles to snip, she'd been returned home intact and relegated to the basement with her litter box and a week's supply of food, to see if this dark confinement might provide her an opportunity to reflect that her new owners weren't to blame for any past inhumane treatment. It did not. In fact, the animal did not take kindly to imprisonment, which might have reminded her of the inside of the burlap bag. There was a small gap between the floor and the bottom of the basement door, and from the top step, Timmy was able to reach underneath and rattle the ill-fitting door about as loudly as a full-grown man would have been able to do with his hand. At first, no one had been willing to believe that a small, angry cat could make such a racket all by herself. But every night, Timmy shook the door until she was let out. Then, to celebrate her freedom, she began shredding the upholstery on the dining room chairs. At the end of a week, Mrs. Whiting instructed the housekeeper to go to the drugstore and buy herself and Cindy and Mrs. Whiting earplugs. Good ones. That night, even with the earplugs, they'd heard Timmy screaming and rattling the door to the basement. But sometime after midnight, the noise ceased, and the three congratulated themselves that the animal spirit was finally broken. The next morning, when the housekeeper came into the kitchen to release the, she imagined, now tame and chastened cat, she got the shock of her life. Indeed, she could not quite believe what she was staring at. The animal's head, blood-fanged, was upside down on the tile floor under the bottom of the cellar door, its two front paws seemingly pinned to the floor when the door had come crashing down. This was the conclusion the poor housekeeper came to, based on the evidence of her senses. She knew, of course, that the door couldn't have come crashing down. This door swung open and shut on two copper hinges, just like all the others. But with the cat's bloody head and paws motionless underneath it, the door appeared to have operated like a garage door, rising into and descending from the ceiling.
It had apparently come slicing down like a guillotine when Timmy had attempted to cross the threshold. So powerful was this optical illusion that the woman's reason was unable to conquer it until Timmy moved. Alas, the resulting apparition of a now squirming, bloody, disembodied, undead cathead sent the woman shrieking from the house. What had happened, it was later deduced, was that the poor woman had interrupted Timmy's escape. Since midnight, the cat, ignoring her bleeding gums, had methodically chewed her way through the bottom of the door. The housekeeper had entered the kitchen just when the hole had gotten large enough for Timmy, squirming on her back, to poke her horrible head and part of one shoulder through. At the housekeeper's sudden appearance, she'd frozen in surprise. It had been, no doubt, a ghastly sight, though only slightly more ghastly than the one Miles was treated to now. Timmy's teeth were not bloody from having chewed through a door, but she'd pulled her lips back and was making sure Miles could see every razor-sharp tooth. Her fur was standing straight up, and her back was arched in the manner of B-movie cats when a ghost, visible to pets but not humans, has just entered the room. Miles, no ghost, instinctively backed away. "Oh, Timmy," Cindy Whiting said, risking her precarious balance to bend down and stroke the beast. "Quit that. Can't you see it's only Miles?" At this, Timmy proceeded to hiss and spit even more emphatically. As Miles, who knew from experience that the owners of savage pets seldom offered much in the way of protection from them, began looking around for a weapon, he heard a distant bell ringing somewhere in the rear of the house. When he turned back toward Timmy, the cat had vanished. "That's Mother," Cindy said, nodding in the direction of the bell. "She must have heard you pull up, and now she's impatient." Miles was still scanning the room for Timmy the cat. "She's waiting out in the gazebo," Cindy explained. "She made me promise to bring you straight out, so you go along." She began to negotiate a slow, awkward turn with her walker. "I'm slow." "That's okay," Miles said, taking her by the elbow, rattled by both the cat and his embarrassing fear of it. The bell continued to ring as they made their slow progress, and when they arrived at the patio door, Miles saw the cat splayed across the inside of the sliding screen, about halfway up, purring loudly, her claws gripping the mesh. The screen was rent in several places, suggesting that this was not the first time Timmy had performed such an acrobatic feat. "She just loves the sound of Mother's bell," Cindy said sweetly. Outside, Miles could see the old woman sitting in the gazebo, facing the river with her back to them, and ringing her bell as if she expected the sound to make fish jump at her command. Everyone else certainly did. Why not the fish? Miles's mother had claimed she could hear her employer's bell ringing in her sleep. Miles again felt his heart soften, considering the saddest truth of Cindy Whiting's existence. Her choice in life was between living at home and answering that bell, and remaining at the state hospital in Augusta. Miles took a deep breath and turned toward her before stepping outside. "Cindy," he said softly. A mistake. Clutching the walker with her left hand, she made a grab for Miles with her right, snagging his shirt sleeve and holding on with amazing strength. "I heard about you and Janine," she said. "Your divorce. I'm so sorry, Miles." He decided on the simple truth. "Me too." But Cindy didn't seem to register his tone. "You never loved her, Miles," Cindy told him. "I know you didn't." "That's what she claims, too," he admitted. Sad that two women as different as Janine and Cindy should have arrived at the same depressing conclusion. Letting go of his shirt, Cindy now caught his fingers in her vice-like grip. "I lied, Miles," she told him, tears starting to spill now. "I'm not sorry about your divorce. It gives me a slender thread of hope." "Cindy," he said, trying to pull away without upsetting her fragile balance. The bell outside was ringing louder now. "I still love you, Miles. You see that, don't you? It's the one thing the lithium can't touch. Did you know that? The drugs wash into your brain and make things easier to bear, but they can't touch your heart. They can't alter what's already there, Miles."
She clasped his hand to her breast so he could feel the truth of what she was saying. Now it seemed to Miles that the bell was playing through a bullhorn inside his head. He tried to withdraw his hand, but could not, at least not without toppling Cindy Whiting. I should go.
Don't, Miles.
Cindy, he said more harshly than he'd planned, as he finally broke free and she again grabbed hold of her walker. Cindy, please. When the walker wobbled, he caught her by the wrist, the same one she'd slashed 20 years ago.
It's okay, she said, visibly gathering herself. Go.
There can't be a God, Miles thought. There just can't be.
Cindy,
he repeated.
No, go,
she said, backing away now, dragging the walker.
I'm fine.
Miles took a deep breath and heard himself say, How about I give you a call sometime this week? At this suggestion, her face lit up so quickly that Miles briefly suspected he'd been tricked.
Really, Miles? You'll call me?
Now the task was to swallow his annoyance.
Why wouldn't I?
He asked, a man with more reasons than he could count.
Oh, Miles.
Her hand again went to her mouth.
Dear, dear Miles.
Dear, dear God. He got as far as the sliding patio door before she called after him. Her expression had darkened into the one he remembered from when she was a girl, a look of terrible recognition.
Miles!
Yes, Cindy?
Outside, when you got out of your car, you stopped and just stood there for a minute. You looked like you wanted to run away.
Miles located the lie he needed. I realized I'd forgotten some stuff I needed to give your mother. You know how she is, receipts for all expenditures. She studied him for a long moment.
I had this terrible thought, she said slowly, that maybe you'd noticed my car and realized I was home.
Cindy, Miles began.
I can bear it that you don't love me, Miles, she said. I've borne it all my life, but if I thought I made you want to run away...
We're old friends, he assured her. I don't want to run away from you. She gave him a smile in which hope and knowledge were going at it, bare-knuckled, equally and eternally matched. No, there was a God after all, Miles concluded, as he took his leave of her. This misery was his plan for us. Instead of thinking about God, what Miles should have been doing was paying attention to Timmy the cat, because when he reached to slide the screen door open, Mrs. Whiting chose that moment to stop ringing her bell, thus releasing Timmy from her trance. In that same instant, her deep, throaty purring stopped, and she reached for Miles, striping the back of his hand.
Oh, Timmy,
Cindy Whiting said when she saw what the cat had done.
You're such a little pill.
Has it ever occurred to you that life is a river, dear boy?